Hello, I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters on Red River Radio. It's one of the most common childhood disorders. It can continue through adolescence and adulthood. It is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. It's one of the most common mental health issues affecting adults, adolescents, as well as children. Symptoms include overactivity, also known as hyperactivity, as well as difficulty paying attention and difficulty with grades in school. Tonight, we welcome our guest. In the studio with us tonight, we have Jenny Barrow, an occupational therapist with the Willis-Knighton Health System, as well as Dr. Bruce McCormick will join us, a clinical psychologist here in Shreveport. Jenny, thank you so much for joining us on Health Matters tonight.
Thank you.
You know, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, it's something that we hear a lot about. Patients talk about it. When I see patients in clinic, they talk about their children having it. They wonder, actually, do I have it as an adult? What is attention hyperactivity disorder?
Attention hyperactivity or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is actually considered a mental disorder. Kiddos can be diagnosed early, kindergarten, before kindergarten, straight up through elementary school, and it does tend to stay with them usually through high school, sometimes adulthood. There are several different types of ADHD. There are kiddos who have trouble with hyperactivity, impulsivity, difficulty focusing in school because they're constantly moving as if they're driven by a motor. That's your hyperactive, impulsive type of ADHD. You also have the inattentive type. The kiddos who tend to daydream and kind of get lost have trouble focusing in that respect.
So there's an inattentive type, and I understand these kids can actually be underdiagnosed or it might be difficult to actually know that they have the disorder?
Very much so. These kiddos, you know the old saying, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. They're not the kids that are out of their seat, running around, sometimes bothering their peers, making a lot of noise because they are quiet and withdrawn sometimes. They're usually diagnosed a little later, sometimes harder to diagnose.
And so looking at the statistics, 5.1 million children have ADHD. The average age of diagnosis is 6 years. You know, severe can be diagnosed at four and a half years old, moderate ADHD diagnosed at 6 years old, mild ADHD diagnosed at 7 years old. What is the youngest that a kid could actually manifest symptoms of ADHD? I know with children that I've been around, and as a father, I've been around children for a long period of time. Hyperactivity, I mean, they're hyper. Kids are hyper from, you know, from birth until at least, you know, they get out of diapers. And so, you know, how do you know what hyper is hyper or hyper is pathological?
That's a great question, and that's one of the reasons why we try not to diagnose too early. In my line of work, occupational therapy, doing pediatric therapy, when we see kiddos, you know, and some of it is normal, especially in our rowdy boys, seeing some hyperactivity, just active, climbing, jumping, running, definitely some of that is normal. We also have kiddos who have sensory integration disorder, where we'll see a lot of the same types of behaviors that are more related to not processing their sensory environment correctly as opposed to ADHD. We also have babies who were severely premature or drug addicted at birth, and you can see some of these behaviors in those kiddos as well. So it's definitely worth it to have the pediatrician follow, watch, have professionals follow them, and wait until they're old enough to make a proper diagnosis.
And in doing some of the research for this show, I looked at the website, the National Institute for Mental Health, and it mentions that the symptoms really need to be present for a certain period of time before one could consider ADHD. How long should someone monitor these symptoms? Let's say they're taking their child to a pediatrician and they're concerned about this.
You know, usually with kiddos that I see in practice, we'll watch them for a good 6 months before kind of referring out and try to rule out, like I said, the sensory integration disorder and some other things first. But definitely they need to be followed and be consistent behaviors. I would say, for at least 6 months to a year. And school is a really good indicator. If they start falling behind in school due to lack of attention and being able to focus, that's definitely a red flag.
This is Red River Radio's Health Matters. Tonight we're talking about ADHD, Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. With us we have Jenny Barrow, an occupational therapist with the Willis-Knighton Health System. We would like to invite you to join our discussion. Our number here is 1-800-552-8502. Again, this is Health Matters on Red River Radio. You know, Jenny, you sent me some statistics on ADHD in Louisiana, and I was really, really shocked that 13% of the children in Louisiana have ADHD. That means 1 out of 10. That's about 2 kids in every classroom have ADHD in Louisiana. Is that true?
According to the CDC in 2011, that is true. It is a popular diagnosis for children, definitely a real diagnosis. As to whether or not it's been properly diagnosed, ruling out other things like sensory integration disorder, that definitely would affect the numbers.
Dr. McCormick is joining us. Dr. Bruce McCormick, a clinical psychologist here in Shreveport. And we're talking about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And thank you very much for joining us. You know, Jenny just mentioned to us that it's a popular diagnosis in Shreveport, or not in Shreveport, presumably Shreveport, but in Louisiana in particular. 13% of children have ADHD. What do you make of that? Is that high compared to other states in our country?
As you noticed a minute ago, it's higher than the national average. And I think there are a number of things we can look at to try to figure out why that is. We may have a population in Louisiana that is more at risk for ADHD. That's certainly one possibility. We also have statewide fewer pediatric or childhood mental health options than a lot of states do. And so what happens is a lot of times when there's a concern about a child, parents need something to hang their hat on, and they say, well, you know, it does kind of look like ADHD, and maybe they'll go see a primary care physician or someone, a counselor or someone, and they'll agree, well, they meet the checklist for symptoms, so let's try it. Let's try treating that. And when you try treating it, of course, you have to have a formal diagnosis. I think that might contribute as well.
And how do you make the diagnosis as a clinical psychologist?
Well, actually, the diagnosis is made in somewhat different ways depending upon one's treatment model. You mentioned a minute ago that sensory integration is something that's oftentimes either confused with or coexists with ADHD. And if you see an occupational therapist, they're more likely than a lot of professionals to screen for that and to notice it. Same thing for the speech pathologist, who's likely to see central auditory processing difficulty. Probably the majority of children who are diagnosed with ADHD are diagnosed by their pediatrician, and that's done by looking at a checklist of the signs and symptoms, probably getting information from schools, and from the teacher and from the parents, and then trying to make a clinical judgment. Well, is this just being a kid, or is this of a degree of frequency and severity that it really warrants a clinical diagnosis? Now, psychologists tend to include some tests and some specific diagnostic instruments with that procedure that, again, it's a different treatment model. And it would be real interesting to see what the diagnostic rate is by healthcare professional, but I don't think we have those data.
This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. With us tonight, we have Jenny Barrow, an occupational therapist with the Willis-Knighton Healthcare System, and Dr. Bruce McCormick, a clinical psychologist here in Shreveport. We welcome your questions. Please call us at 1-800-552-8502. Our topic tonight is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. You know, Jenny, Dr. McCormick mentioned sensory integration problems and sensory auditory processing. Explain to us a little bit about what those symptoms might look like to patients, to parents, as well as teachers.
For a lot of kiddos, the sensory integration dysfunction, the symptoms of that disorder definitely can mimic the hyperactive impulsive type of ADHD. For kiddos who are not properly, we'll say, modulating some of the sensory input that's coming in from their environment, they will find a way to get it. They will seek it out. A really popular one that tends to be confused with ADHD is the proprioceptive sense, them kind of knowing their body position in space. They need to move to actually achieve that. If I were to tell you to close your eyes and touch your nose, you could do that without, you know, visual compensation. A lot of kiddos can't do that. And so they move to get input to their muscles and joints. When you translate that to the classroom setting, you have the child that's expected to sit still at a desk and learn. And while he's sitting still, he is losing his sense of awareness of where his body is in space. And so he's going to get up. He's going to rock in his chair. He's going to get up and push his friend. He's going to move around to seek that sensory input.
So seeking sensory input, obviously kids are very sensory hungry, you know, as babies. I mean, they're always touching and feeling, tasting, putting things in their mouth. And then we basically immerse these kids, whether it's in preschool or in kindergarten, into a very controlled environment. So again, what is sensory dysfunction or normal behavior for a child who's 5 years old going into kindergarten?
And for a kiddo that's, when you're that young, you learn through your senses. We learn through movement. We learn through play. We learn through getting messy and making mistakes. And so it is hard to differentiate some of that. And, you know, what makes it even harder is that we are not all cookie-cutter learners. If we all learned it the same way, it would be much easier to tell when we have some dysfunction. But we've got kinesthetic learners that need to move. We've got visual learners that use their eyes. So that kind of muddies the water a little bit as well.
This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. We have a question emailed ahead of time. We also will take questions live. This is a live show, and the number is 1-800-552-8502. Our topic is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Dr. McCormick, we have a question via email. What are the tests and criteria used to diagnose attention deficit hyperactivity disorder?
Well, it's a great question, and the answer to that varies a lot on which healthcare professional you see, which individual, and from what training model or what profession. Almost universal are some types of checklists where possible behaviors that could represent symptoms of ADHD are listed, and someone who knows the child well, a parent, a teacher, or maybe ideally a combination, will say, yes, this child has these characteristics, a little bit, a middle amount, a whole lot, a great, 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 great deal. And looking at the combination of information from checklists is, I think, almost universal. The pediatricians tend to use one called the Vanderbilt checklist. It does accurately represent the symptoms of ADHD. It also has nothing to do with Vanderbilt. They don't use it at Vanderbilt University. But it does list do a good job of listing the signs and symptoms. Where it may fall short is giving some indication about other conditions that could mimic ADHD, such as sensory integration or any number of other conditions. If there are school problems, if there are learning problems, if there are behavior problems, tests such as school aptitude tests are often used in conjunction with checklists. And there are a number of instruments that are done typically via computer called continuous performance test. And this is the closest thing we have to a real test for ADHD because they require the person being tested, the child or the adult, to pay attention and then do something, either click a mouse or punch a button. It depends on the particular format of the particular test. And they last for several minutes. And if you have trouble paying attention, if you have trouble exercising self-control, after a while you don't do so well on these tests. And those are often a very, very valuable part. They're not in and of themselves enough, but as one big piece of information. And those are specific for ADHD.
So these are psychological tests. You know, just to remind our listeners, this is a psychological condition. So in general, there's nothing on an MRI scan of the brain that's going to tell us, you know, providers, that your child has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. There's not a blood test. There's not an X-ray. There's nothing that's completely objective about the diagnosis. Is that true?
I'm afraid that is true. And I hope someday, I think maybe someday we'll have some genetic testing that will let us have a better picture, because it is an inherited condition. We do know that as a group, there are differences on PET scans and MRIs for, say, 1,000 people with ADHD and 1,000 people who don't. But there are also a lot of people who don't who show up like they do, and a lot of people who do who show up like they don't. So it's just not ready for prime-time diagnostic use. It's still very much in the research laboratory.
And you mentioned a moment ago, you know, a patient or a child may have some of these symptoms, and you might sort of try on the diagnosis, maybe offer some treatment. How does that play into your diagnostic accuracy, response to therapy, for example, whether it's occupational therapy, something you might do, Jenny, or medication, something that you might do, Dr. McCormick?
Well, you know, typically when kiddos come to us, they either do or do not have the diagnosis. With kiddos in therapy, whether it's speech therapy, occupational therapy, a lot of times we will notice some of those symptoms and start to kind of track some of those and help the parent in recognizing some of those and going through the right channels, talking with their pediatrician to get the diagnosis. Unfortunately, I recognize some of it, but we cannot diagnose, so we guide them through that process.
I think the toughest cases of all are those where we're kind of stumped with it. We say, you know, there's enough there that it could be, but we're not sure if it is. And that usually happens if there's something else going on as well. And typically what I do in my clinic is discuss with the parents and say, okay, let's assume that your child does have ADHD and treat it and see how he or she responds. Or let us assume that they do not and let us take care of what looks like sensory integration issues, and we'll interface with speech paths, with speech language pathologists, with occupational therapists. Let's see if we treat other things, if we get a good response. And sometimes you have to just decide which way you're going to go, but certainly provide active treatment. And if you're right, you've got the right condition, you'll get a response. I don't know anybody that's ever been hurt by occupational therapy treatment, even if maybe that wasn't the way we would have gone. And that's a more conservative approach. And I tend to prefer that rather than just starting with something like medication.
You know, something that I was reading, again, on the National Institute of Mental Disorders, that they recommended that patients actually start with non-medical therapy or non-pharmacological therapy, especially when they're diagnosed at an early age. And I'm thinking, well, the patients that are diagnosed at an early age may actually have a more severe form of the disease, right? And so speak a little bit about that. You know, when should patients actually, you know, get medications at what age? Let's say they do have prominent symptoms of ADHD, and Dr. McCormick, they may actually have a genetic history as well.
Mm-hmm. I think the main question for a young child who may have ADHD in terms of how we go about treatment is how much impact is it having on his or her life? Your point was very well made that children learn, particularly young children, learn by doing. And if they are having to spend a lot of time in the corner, or when they're hanging out with the other kids, nobody wants to let them hold the puppy because they're afraid they're going to be too rough. If it's impacting their life, and ADHD, remember, is not just a school condition. It deals with emotions. It deals with behavior. It deals with learning. It deals with social experiences. If a child is having enough impairment in those areas that he or she's not developing as well, or not having the opportunities to develop, then you might want to get more aggressive in treatment. And I have treated kids with medication at an age much younger than I would like to, but sometimes it's really been necessary, and it's made a world of difference.
Yeah, we actually had a question submitted. At what age should a parent begin to be concerned and have their child screened for ADHD?
I would say if you're noticing symptoms, whether it's hyperactivity, impulsivity, definitely get on that early. And when we get little ones, maybe that do not have a diagnosis yet, I usually kind of hit it from all angles, assume that maybe it's sensory processing disorder, do everything that I know to do. And I'll tell my parents, you know, when we kind of treat it like it's sensory processing disorder, we may clean some of that up, but it will also leave a clearer picture of what's left. And at that point, if we can't integrate all of that, then I would refer out. But I think definitely the earlier we address that, the better, because we are dealing with a child who has got emotions and self-image, and we want to make sure that they have a positive self-image and, you know, don't become the self-fulfilling prophecy, like you said, that they're too rough with the puppy or that they don't play well with friends.
I agree completely with that. I think your remarks bring up something that's very, very important, particularly at a younger age, and that is the value of a multidisciplinary diagnostic look. You know, the old saying, if the only thing you've got is a hammer, everything kind of looks like a nail. Hopefully pediatric professionals will at least screen for things that are maybe not within their area of expertise, but I'm much more comfortable if we have OTs and speech pathologists, pediatricians and all on the team, so we can look at all aspects of what's going on and come up with a treatment plan.
Yeah, this is definitely a multidisciplinary type of disorder. It affects all aspects of the patient's life as well as affects their family. And it's easy to, you know, just be prone to give a child a medication, expect the medication to work and everything is fine. But as you mentioned, you know, it's a multidisciplinary, multifactorial disorder. We have another question via the internet submitted ahead of time. Can a child who is a straight-A student scoring two grade levels above their current grade level on tests really have ADHD? I guess the question is, is normal intelligence, normal academic functioning possible and also have the diagnosis of ADHD?
It is absolutely possible. It's very, very much like needing glasses. Can you be very bright and make good grades even though you need glasses and don't have them? Yes, you can. Your eyes are going to get more tired. There's some things you're going to miss, and you may work twice as hard for those A's. But if you have the cognitive horsepower to do it, you can, at least up to a point. I find a lot of people who have been very bright and very well motivated and undiagnosed with ADHD or ADD that don't come in for the first time until maybe they're in their senior year of high school or their first or second year of college. I've even had some folks that held it together all the way until I got to law school, and then just the volume of the stuff, even though they were very bright, was more than they could handle. Kind of like trying to do law school without glasses. So it is quite possible.
Again, this is Health Matters on Red River Radio. We would like to invite your participation in our show. The number here tonight is 1-800-552-8502. With us tonight, we have Jenny Barrow, an occupational therapist with the Willis-Knighton Health System, and Dr. Bruce McCormick, a clinical psychologist here in Shreveport. So, Dr. McCormick, you were just mentioning the law student, you know, who finally gets to the point where they need to see someone for their attention and focus problems, and perhaps that student has a child, and they may be at elevated risk for having ADHD. What should parents do if they have a new diagnosis themselves of ADHD and they have children that they're concerned about?
Oh, it's a very good question, and it actually works both ways, too. Sometimes, not uncommonly, I'll diagnose a child with ADHD, and by the time we've discussed the condition, the parents, one or both of them, will say, you know, I realize that maybe this has been me all along, and it hasn't been, hasn't been identified. But your question, what if the parents realize that they have it? There is a strong hereditary component to ADHD. And anybody, any first-degree relative, a mom, dad, brother, sister, has that condition, then being aware, paying much more attention to the signs and symptoms, and other family members is well advised. If you tell me that you have a brother or a sister that has ADHD without any other information, I know that you've got a 1 in 2 to 1 in 3 chance of having it yourself with no other information at all.
1 in 2 to 1 in 3.
That's correct.
And so, Jenny, you mentioned to us that 1 out of 10, basically, or actually slightly more, children have ADHD, at least in Louisiana. So we're saying at least 1 out of 20 adults have it? If the chances are 50% that it's inherited?
Definitely sounds logistic.
The prevalence rate nationally for adults is supposed to be around 60%. I think that's an under... 60% of those who are diagnosed at a young age will continue to meet diagnostic criteria as adults. I think that's probably an underestimate because adults in many ways learn to cope and compensate. We know as a group they tend to be undereducated, underemployed, have more marital distress, a lot more car wrecks, and be incarcerated more. That doesn't mean any adult who has that are going to have those things, but there are some reasons that they don't pop up on the statistics at that age. Yeah, if we have, 1 in 10 in Louisiana, theoretically we would have 6 in 10. 10% in Louisiana, supposedly we would have 6% of our adults with that diagnosis. As far as we know, I'm not sure how solid the national data are on that right now.
This aspect of the discussion is quite interesting, but we have callers. So let's take our first caller tonight. We have Celeste from Lovelady, Texas. Celeste, thank you for joining us on Health Matters tonight.
Thank you for taking my call. I have several questions, and I'm so thankful that this is on the air because I'm getting ready to talk to some teachers about this exact issue, but more with sensory processing disorder. So at the beginning, you talked about, I think the occupational therapist talked about the ADHD having the component, the hyperactive component, but also the inattentive component. And then she talked about the sensory processing disorder with a sensory craver. But could she talk about the sensory processing component that is also the under performer, the sensory underseeker, or not underseeker, what is it, sensory underresponsive? And then I was wondering about if the doctor could talk about the side effects of medication, you know, what a serious decision this is for people. I think, you know, we're in a society where we want to take a pill to fix everything, but there, I think, are a lot of side effects that we need to consider. And also, if the physician could address what is the pushback of sensory processing disorder not being accepted as a diagnosis for the DSM?
Celeste, let's check in with Jenny and see what she thinks about your first question.
Okay.
Hi, Celeste. You know, sensory processing disorder, and it runs a whole, boy, we could do a whole show on just that topic alone. If you can kind of picture a continuum for each area that we think of, all of your senses, each area that we process this information coming in from our environment, there's a continuum. And most of us kind of process about halfway through that continuum. We can take so much input before we're maybe overstimulated. For the movement seekers, the cravers that I was talking about earlier, the ones that don't have a really good sense of their body awareness and space, maybe, they're on the top end of that continuum for proprioceptive input. They take lots and lots of input before they know where they are. On the other end of that continuum, you have the kiddo who doesn't like to do a lot of moving, maybe doesn't like to bear weight through their joints. We see a lot of kids that start walking late because of this, or they refuse to crawl because they don't want to bear weight through their joints. And we have that continuum in every aspect of sensory processing. So in what you touch, what you hear, even what you see, visual stimulation. So for a lot of those kids that maybe are very reserved in the classroom, they don't want to explore the paints or the different textures. They don't engage maybe in certain types of play because it's too loud. A lot of those kiddos could have sensory processing disorder, and I suppose in some ways that maybe could mimic or be confused with the you know, the type of ADHD that's more the inattentive type.
Dr. McCormick, we're going to get to the drugs. I think we're going to need to talk a lot about those. But the last part of the question was about making the diagnosis. Is it important to make a diagnosis of something that's quite, you know, quite vague at times, it seems like?
Well, and I think, Celeste, if I understood your question, you wondered about the diagnosis of ADHD as well as the diagnosis of sensory integration, which I'm going to defer to Jenny for that particular. But I think you also asked about side effects of medication. Is that correct?
Yes.
Certainly, most medications have side effects, and the ones that are most commonly used for ADHD have some definite and well-known side effects. Almost every single time when I'm talking about medication with a parent, I will hear something like, I don't want him to be zombied out. I don't want to lose her personality, things like that. And those are not a common side effects, but the ones that are most common for medications with ADHD are some loss of appetite. And that's usually managed real well. Kids eat less lunch, but they want to eat more supper, more evening snacks, more breakfast. And there are some other ways to manage that if it becomes problematic. One of the things I remind parents is that when we're talking about the side effects of losing their personality or becoming zombied out, unlike a strep throat infection where you pretty much know how much the child weighs, you know how much medicine to give them, it's very, very, the dosing is very, very individual for ADHD. I've had a medical student look like a defensive tackle that took 30 milligrams of the same medicine that I had a middle school student taking 70 milligrams of. It's very, very individual. So it is easy in, although I really like people, I recommend that people be start low and go slowly with medications. It's certainly possible to cross the line where you've got some side effects that are just unacceptable. But I tell people if your child's zombied out, then either the diagnosis is not correct or you're not telling your prescriber what they need to know, because that is not an acceptable or necessary part of doing business. Yes, something like that might happen today, but shouldn't happen tomorrow, because don't give them the medicine tomorrow. It's not a permanent change, and you're not wrecking your personality.
Celeste, thank you so much for calling. You know, Dr. McCormick, we were talking about drugs with the previous caller. What drugs are actually used to treat attention deficit hyperactivity disorder?
Well, interestingly, there are 15 or 20 different medications available, but most of them use the same molecules, stimulants, either, you know, the chemically, they're methylphenidate or dextroamphetamine. The problem was most of these stimulants, well, both of each of these stimulants that are usually very effective, have what we call a half-life, or how long they last in the body, of only 2 or 3 hours. So to avoid having to take many, many, many pills a day just to keep an even blood level, there are a number of different time-release mechanisms. Some of them are very creative, everything from having the medicine change when it is digested to skin patches that don't even go through the gastrointestinal system. They're all aimed at trying to provide as smooth a blood level as possible for as long as possible. It wasn't too long ago before kids had to go to the office at lunchtime and take their pill, and that's much, much, much less common now. But those are the two chemicals, and as I say, brand names and delivery systems for time release. There are many, many. There are also a couple of other medicines, guanfacine, and atomoxetine, called Strattera and 10X or Intuniv, that are useful sometimes with ADHD. They tend not to be used as the only medicine, but oftentimes as an add-on to kind of top things off. And they have generally an easier side effect profile.
Do you feel like patients should use medications as tools for maybe more difficult times? Let's say they're having a stressful semester, you know, in high school or college, or, you know, kids leading up to testing and things along those lines. We hear about the medications being used, may I say, strategically. Is that appropriate or is that inappropriate use of the medication?
Well, and there are two aspects to that. One is it appropriate for someone who has ADHD, and one is it appropriate for someone who does not have ADHD? We know that these medicines are performance enhancers. They give them to Air Force fighter pilots and bomber pilots if they have to fly 18-hour missions. And there's a big question about how appropriate, medically safe, and ethical it is to use these medications as performance enhancers to study for your finals. It's not legal. It is done quite commonly on college campuses.
Shelley is back. Shelley, thank you for calling us on Red River Radio. What's your question?
Yes, I'd like to ask the experts, what is the best way to broach the subject with maybe a spouse or even an older child that you suspect may have ADHD and you'd like for them to get some testing or, you know, an assessment? How do you present that to them in a way that they might be receptive to that?
What an awesome question. So often I'll have one parent call me and say, "No, you know, I'm not sure his mom wants to come in about this, or I'm not sure his dad's in agreement with this." And I think the key to that is understanding the condition. There's so many myths and misunderstandings about ADHD. Is it a real condition? You know, are we just giving kids pills so we don't have to take care of them? And I think it's incumbent upon parents to talk to the older teen or adolescent or their spouse and say, you know, let's find out more about this. It's also incumbent upon the healthcare professional to listen. And it's not something you can do in an 8-minute med check. You've got to really understand, meet the folks where they are, and help them know what they need to know to make the decisions that are ultimately the parents' decisions.
You know, Jenny, as a parent, I don't like the idea of my child being diagnosed with anything. You know, I like their medical record to be clean. You know, that gives me reassurance that, you know, we've taken good care of them, and we know that, you know, anything that seems like it's chronic is appropriately addressed, and it's not necessarily a medical or neurological condition. So how do you approach telling a child that they have a disorder that may or may not have been inherited? You know, Dr. McCormick, they may or may not need medication for the rest of their life. What do we tell a child who's in kindergarten or first grade that there's actually something wrong with them that they may need medication for the rest of them of their lives? And, you know, how is that going to affect them socially as well?
You know, I think approaching it from a very neutral standpoint, and letting them know that you are there to help them, to guide them. You know, kiddos that have ADHD, they know that there's something a little different. They know that it's a little harder, maybe to learn certain things the way it's being taught. I find as a therapist and as a parent, I have dealt with this as a parent as well, that trying to show that you love, that you care, and that you are a team player, a helper to try to minimize this condition as much as possible and to make sure that child is that happy, healthy, productive, effective learner is the best approach.
This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. Our guest tonight, Jenny Barrow, an occupational therapist with the Willis-Knighton Health System, and Dr. Bruce McCormick, clinical psychologist here in Shreveport. Our number here is 1-800-552-8502. We welcome your participation. Please call us with your questions. You know, Dr. McCormick, we were talking about, is there a stigma associated with having this diagnosis?
And that goes very well with Jenny's comments regarding how do you talk to children. Whatever stigma is there doesn't really seem to start with the kids. I think it's more parents and teachers' concern. I don't have many kids that worry about it as long as it's presented in a developmentally appropriate way. If they say, oh, you're going to have to take your medicine because you just don't make good grades, it's a lot different than saying, yeah, we're taking this, but man, look what you did. And I really think attributing the successes, even if they were facilitated by medication, attributing the successes to the child's intellect, ability, effort is the key to making it a healthy overall treatment program.
Absolutely.
So emphasizing the success of treatment, how do you actually measure success in treatment, Jenny?
Well, I think first and foremost, the child can usually tell you they feel better, they understand better, a fog has kind of been lifted. And definitely grades. A lot of the kids that we see in treatment when we're doing some therapeutic things along with medication, sometimes not along with medication, but the grades come up and the parents are happier. You know, home life is happier because homework is no fun for the parents or the child when ADHD is involved, unregulated ADHD.
Unregulated ADHD. How often do you see grades actually come up within, let's say, Dr. McCormick, you know, 1 month, 2 months from beginning of treatment? Is this a rapid response that we seek to achieve, or is it something that's going to take some time?
Very, very much depends on what grade and what class and what types of assignments. But right away, you see improvement in learning behavior. Homework that used to be a two-hour battle may becomes a 45-minute efficient time. Now, it depends on whether they're, you know, how that class is tested and whether it's a long-term paper or whatnot as to whether the grades are actually reflected or how long it takes. But the response is almost immediate. Again, it's very much like wearing glasses. If all of a sudden you can see, you can read a lot better. Does that make your grades go up? Yeah. How soon? Kind of depends on the class.
So it depends on the class. Jenny, do you see any particular subject responding more quickly than others? I know, you know, math is very, very difficult to pay attention to if you're having trouble with what you mentioned, the sensory integration issues. And so a child who's starting on ADHD medication and they're having difficulty in school, what subjects do you expect to see the most rapid change in?
You know, I don't know if there is one particular subject that I've experienced with my patients having a higher rate of success or improvement in. Definitely with math, you know, boy, they're teaching it a lot differently now than they used to, and there are a whole lot of additional steps. And I find that for many of my children that I treat, that is difficult because hanging on until the end of all of those steps, boy, they get lost somewhere between, you know, the beginning of the end and the end. So I think for all of the classes, just being able to have that sustained attention to what's going on shows improvement. I don't know that necessarily one class over another would show faster improvement.
And we've been talking a lot about parents and a lot about the children, but the teachers are spending, you know, 6-8 hours a day with these children, both diagnosed and undiagnosed. What should children or what should teachers look for in terms of helping out these parents who may have a child with ADHD? Because, you know, the common complaint is that, you know, the teacher's having a problem with the child. You know, is the teacher overworked? You know, is the child really having more of a discipline? You know, I'm making the quote sign here, a discipline problem, or is this really ADHD? So what can we tell the teachers out there that might be listening?
Teachers are not trained and don't necessarily have the knowledge base to make a diagnosis, but listen closely. Teachers can tell when something is wrong. So, and the teachers don't have to make a diagnosis. They just need to let mom and dad know that, hey, compared to the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of children I've seen, something here isn't right. It may be any number of conditions, but we need to... I really recommend that you have your child seen by someone. Now, that gets tricky because school systems are very cautious about what they allow teachers to recommend to parents for legal reasons. But if the teacher has a concern, pay attention to it and then find someone who is able to say, well, you know, could this be sensory integration? Could this be a sensory problem? Could this be a cognitive problem, an ADHD problem, things like that? And it's very important to remember that you don't always just have one. Sometimes these things cluster. You may have more than one thing going on at the same time.
And oftentimes, you know, it's in a difficult home. We mentioned that, you know, socioeconomic challenged children, you know, may have a higher incidence of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. You know, if their parent has a disorder and it's not been diagnosed, you know, that can be even more of a problem for the child. And so these can be difficult problems for the teachers to face. And we mentioned 13% of children in Louisiana may have ADHD. So we're talking about two out of every teacher's classroom. If you're talking about a high school teacher, you're talking about, you know, 12 to 20 kids that they see throughout the day may or may not have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So we're asking a lot of the teachers, as we normally do. They're working hard for our children. And so they're expressing their concerns. So I think it's important in both respects not to expect them to be diagnosticians, but also at the same time hear them, mm-hmm. you know, hear their concerns, have parent-teacher conferences, and not necessarily think the teachers are just trying to throw drugs at our children so that they'll sit down. We have another email question. If a child can sit for hours and hours and play and then can't sit in class, is that attention deficit hyperactivity disorder? I think of my son, you know, he can sit there with Legos or, you know, heaven forbid, my iPad for an hour or 2 hours at a time. And then, you know, what's going on in the classroom when they're having to learn something that might not be quite as exciting as Legos or a game on an iPad?
I think it's very possible for a child with some attention problems with ADHD to be able to have an activity of choice and sit for hours, be well entertained, play well with others. Yet when they're in a classroom having to pay attention to something that's not of their choice, it's much more difficult. You now have that fight for their attention. It's with textbooks, you know, reading a textbook is much more difficult than reading a novel of your choice, something that you're motivated to read that you've picked out yourself. So absolutely, I think that's very possible.
And there's actually a difference in what's going on in the brain when there's an activity that is pulling my attention and I don't have to exert effort to attend, and something where I need to focus my attention even though it isn't intrinsically motivated. They're very different brain activities. And yes, you'll see that. You'll see kids who could do the Legos or the fishing or the iPad or the video games for minutes and hours on end, but they really neurologically cannot attend to something if they have to force themselves to, even if they want to. But it looks like a kid who just needs a big, swift kick and they have a motivational problem. That's not always the case, certainly not with ADHD.
This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. Our topic tonight is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. We welcome your calls at 1-800-552-8502. With us tonight, we have Jenny Barrow, an occupational therapist with the Willis-Knighton Health System, and also Dr. Bruce McCormick, a clinical psychologist here in Shreveport. Let's go ahead and talk about some of the environmental issues. No, Dr. McCormick, we talked about genetic issues. Mm-hmm. And Jenny, you and I were discussing some of the other issues that come into play when we're talking about ADHD diagnosis and some of the food issues and some of the other environmental issues that could come into play. What do you see as the most important thing that parents can look for in terms of their children's environment, whether it's, you know, exposure to the wrong types of foods and things along those lines?
Boy, that's a great question. Food definitely can be a trigger for lots of kids, especially kiddos who have asthma allergies. They may have a higher maybe intolerance for some foods, sensitivities to some foods, and the inability to properly digest maybe all the proteins in a certain food can absolutely affect behavior. Additives, preservatives, along with some of your more highly reactive foods definitely can be difficult for a child and make changes in their behavior, produce changes in their behavior.
So what sort of diets would you say a patient with ADHD should be aware of? I know dietary treatment. We know we're talking about actual diagnosis and causation, but dietary treatment can come into play as well. So since we're talking about food a little bit, what should the ADHD child be fed?
That's a great question, because that can vary from child to child. A lot of our ADHD kiddos do well on a high-protein diet. Protein's kind of the building block of neurotransmitters, and many of them will do well with protein at or more protein than carbs at breakfast and lunch to help to keep them focused. We do have children who are very sensitive to gluten and casein in their diet. So a lot of the wheats and the dairies, those foods, they have a hard time digesting. And then we do have some children that do well after doing an elimination diet where they avoid, it's difficult, it's effective, but it's difficult, where they avoid the six most reactive foods, which are wheat, dairy, eggs, peanuts, corn, and soy, which is a big chunk of what we eat, especially for families on the go. They're eating processed foods. But for some kiddos, that can make a huge difference. Removing some of those foods that they're reacting to make a huge difference in their behaviors and attention levels.
Okay, thank you very much. We have another caller. Welcome to Health Matters.
Hello.
Hello, welcome to Health Matters on Red River Radio.
This is Angie from Lufkin.
Hi, Angie. Thanks for calling. Sorry, we've been having trouble with the phone lines. What's your question? Thanks for calling.
Well, I really don't have a question, but I wanted to make a statement. I am just so excited to hear this program. I am a big Red River Radio listener and supporter, but I wanted to make a statement that I'm very proud of. I have a 21-year-old son who was diagnosed with ADHD at the age of 5. And it was bounce off the wall, crawl the wall, crawl the ceiling. But we had an excellent support system, excellent counselors, and he was diagnosed by a neurologist. And the hardest part of the whole situation was coming to the grip and the reality that Chase was actually suffering more than we as parents were. And we followed a food regimen. We followed prescribed medication and therapy and different types of in-classroom and communication with our neighbors, our friends, our relatives, to prevent labeling of this child. As he got older, one of the most important things for us was to talk with Chase, and so that he would become aware of what was going on and how he could work in conjunction with this medication, with the programs he was involved in, to become a successful person as he grew older. We've had much success, much success. My son is not medicated now. He excelled in school. He's done very well. We've had no drug and alcohol abuse problems. This was one of the biggest things we were concerned about. because of the type of drug, but it is successful. It can be successful with a very good, large network and support system. And I'm just so excited to hear this on the radio. It just really validates everything that we went through, and I want to thank you for that.
You're certainly welcome, Angie, and thank you so much for calling. The topic of alcohol and drug abuse with ADHD, it seems like that disorder can intersect somewhat, those disorders. And so, Dr. McCormick, are patients with ADHD prone to alcohol and drug abuse, and how does that change if they get the diagnosis and they get appropriately treated?
Oh, an excellent question, and a very, very relevant one. We know from the epidemiological research that people with ADHD are much more likely to have problems with substance abuse, including alcohol, including illicit drugs, and including tobacco. Less than 30%, 20-some-odd percent of the people in Louisiana and nationally use cigarettes regularly, but over 80% of people with ADHD do. Similarly, abuse of substances of all types, but certainly including alcohol, occur at a much higher rate for people with ADHD. The notion is that probably they are attempting, even though they may not realize it, to self-medicate for their condition and try to feel better. One of the things parents say to me often is, I don't want to use medicine because I'm afraid my kid's going to get the idea that the drugs are helpful. And what we've learned from very, very detailed study of this is if a child who really needs treatment for ADHD is treated with medication, their risk for substance abuse goes way down, almost to the level of someone who does not have ADHD, whereas if they remain untreated, their risk for substance abuse, illegal and unhealthy, remains very high.
You know, this is maybe a public health issue. Should our addiction treatment units be screening these patients, especially adolescents, young adults, for ADHD when they're admitted for detox and things along those lines? Dr. McCormick, what do you think about that?
I agree absolutely that it should be. And frankly, I don't know why it's not done, except diagnostic overshadowing. Someone comes in with a serious drug abuse problem, we try to treat that, and a lot of times we don't stop and say what else is there, which could include ADHD or some mood disorders. Given the high association of, well, adults with ADHD, 84% have a second psychiatric condition, the most common being anxiety, and the second most common being substance abuse, and the third one's depression. So I don't know why it's not looked at more often.
We have another caller. We have Teresa. Teresa, thank you for calling Red River Radio and Health Matters tonight.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. My question is, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
My question is, I have a 20-year-old son who is epileptic. Also was diagnosed as a child before the epilepsy started. He did not start having seizures till he was 16. But in his younger life, he was diagnosed with ADHD. He's made two attempts in college. The first attempt was on medication, and he started having a cluster of seizures. He's not a very bad epileptic. He only averages maybe one every 3 to 4 months, so that's not bad at all. But when he had this cluster of seizures, the neurologist immediately took him off of the ADHD medication and has not allowed him to get back on anything since. His second attempt at college was a failure. Is there any advice you can give me?
Thank you so much, Teresa, for calling us. Dr. McCormick, what do you think about Teresa's question?
Well, the course of treatment that you're talking about, Teresa, certainly makes sense. When epilepsy or other seizure disorders are not treated, the medications usually used for ADHD can make the seizure risk much higher. And the treatment protocol that's commonly accepted is get the seizures under control and then in close consultation with the neurologist, once they're controlled, consider what medications might be used, including some of those that might be epileptogenic otherwise that could cause seizures. But first priority for any number of health reasons is get the seizures under control. There are some medicines that can be used for ADD that do not increase the seizure risk, but the neurologist should be part of the treatment team from here on out.
We have another caller, Alan from Shreveport. Alan, what's your question?
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Dr. McCormick, it's my understanding that oftentimes kids are diagnosed with ADD and ADHD through screening tools utilizing parent and teacher reporting, and the diagnosis and management is performed by a pediatrician. How specific are those screening tools at distinguishing between true ADHD symptoms versus, let's say, parenting styles, such as perhaps a more lax parenting styles where the children are not in a structured environment, let's say, not being allowed to talk at, you know, to interrupt and be impulsive and demonstrate impulsive behavior at home, and then they go to school and they're expected to conform to more standard, different standards. How do those screening tools how do they help distinguish between parenting styles in the home and true ADHD symptoms?
Well, that's a great question, and the answer is the screening instruments that you're speaking of do a very good job of recording and measuring reports by parents, those who know a child, of the symptoms of ADHD. They do not do a good job of differentiating where those symptoms may be coming from, because you can have characteristics of ADHD, as you point out, they come from environmental conditions and other medical problems as well. That's where hopefully the pediatrician knows the child, knows the family, and there's some clinical judgment that comes into play. And of course, my bias being a psychologist is that maybe those instruments are a good start, but not as comprehensive as needs to be in place. But frankly, pediatricians don't have the time, and insurance companies don't like to cover some of the stuff you really need to do.
Yeah, so definitely look at the entire family dynamic. Jenny, we have another question that was asked to you specifically. What about executive processing delays and ADHD? Can you speak about that for just a moment?
I can. You know, executive processing skills, which is kind of that inner voice, almost like a conscience, if you will. You know, that the kiddo that maybe has a test coming up or a project due, I need to go ahead and study for that. And it keeps them on track with things. That comes in later for a lot of kids, especially for our boys, and definitely can heighten the problems with ADHD, especially in school.
Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us on Health Matters tonight. This is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or a health professional. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, with production assistance provided this evening by Wally Derleth. Thank you for your help, Wally, on the telephones as well, and by Daniel Gordy. Support for this program comes from the Noel Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. You may also listen to a podcast of this program on our website, redriverradio.org. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.